I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episodes 1 and 2 of the team's latest series on Darrell Ewing, a Michigan man who was arrested in 2010 at the age of 21 for the murder of J.B. Watson. If you haven't listened to these episodes yet, this conversation probably won't make a whole lot of sense. So go back, listen to the 2 episodes. You will not regret it. And then come back because we will still be here. We have a couple of very special guests today, including Maggie Freeling. She worked as a public radio producer for years and is now the host and producer of her own shows, Murder in Alliance and Unjust and Unsolved, focusing on wrongful convictions and the crimes that are consequently left unsolved. She's also the host and producer of Suave from PRX, one of my favorite podcasts of the last several years. She also teaches journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School at CUNY and was a TV documentary host for Vice and previously Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray. Maggie Freeling, it's so great to talk to you again.
Thank you, Rebecca. That is truly an honor coming from you, one of your favorite podcasts in years.
Oh, I think it's brilliant. And anyone in listening to this who has not checked out Suave, it is unlike anything you've heard before. It's really, really special for lots of reasons, and I don't want to spoil it. So that's why I'm not going to say why, but it's special. Please just trust me on that. Also with us is Abigail Gowdy. Abigail is a rising third-year law student at the University of South Carolina School of Law. She graduated from the University of South Carolina with a degree in criminal justice in 2018. She's a native of Spartanburg, South Carolina, and after law school plans to remain in South Carolina pursuing her passion for justice and defending the accused. Abigail, it's a pleasure to meet you.
It's so nice to meet you too. Thank y'all so much for letting me join y'all. I'm super excited. So...
Well, finally with us is your teacher and mine, Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. He's one of the hosts of Undisclosed Podcast, and he's my favorite legal Siri. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. Thrilled to talk to you today.
So, Abigail, before we get started talking about this case, let's just talk about Colin for a second. I've never had the chance to talk to one of his real-life students before, even though I think anyone who listens to Undisclosed is a student of his by extension. So what is it like having Colin as a teacher?
He is the best, and I'm not just saying that because he's letting me come on the podcast. He really loves to bring in so much real world experience to what can kind of feel like a lot of books and old cases and things like that. He puts all of his students in the class just right into whatever it is that he's doing as well. So, if he's working on a case or if he's interested in something, he brings it to all of us, and it really just helps with making learning law seem like a very practical and important experience versus just reading something from 1700 that can be a little bit dry. So he's fantastic.
Is his ability to cite case law from states old times incredible in the classroom as it is incredible on the podcast? It just seems like he's encyclopedic that way.
It is one of the most mind-boggling things. Even as a 1L student in our first year with him, we would talk about how does he know all this from memory? And it goes through every single class that you have with him. Any class that I've taken with him, I have friends texting me there's no way that he just has all of this knowledge in his mind, but he does. And I'm very jealous of him for it because I do not have all of that just in my memory, but I don't know how he does it. It's insane to listen to.
And final question, does he also bring the pop culture knowledge to the classroom?
I think that he does. I think that he does, but I'm new on Twitter. I have not been on Twitter previously, and I have seen his Twitter, and I think he brings a lot of the pop culture to that. And I'm jealous that no one told me about his Twitter presence really up until now, because I could have learned a lot more about music and things that are also very important other than law school things.
1980s sitcoms, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. And I saw something about some candy bars that I hadn't heard of before that are kind of like a Reese cup, like just things that you need to know in life that I had not seen before.
Critical information for sure.
Yeah, very, very, very critical.
Well, let's talk about the real reason we're here. And that is this Undisclosed series on Darrell Ewing. So in episode one of the series, the Undisclosed team started telling the story of Darrell Ewing, a 21-year-old accused of a shooting murder that occurred at 3:40 p.m. at an intersection in the east side of Detroit. You heard from Darrell and his family, who claim that he was at a repast at that exact time, helping to set up a slideshow to celebrate the life of his grandmother's best friend. In episode two, the Undisclosed team looked into a man named Tyree Washington, who confessed to the murder of J.B. Watson before Darrell Ewing's trial, and who has now given a recorded confession detailing exactly why and how he killed J.B. Watson. Now, Maggie, you covered this case on an episode of your podcast, Unjust and Unsolved, last fall. So can you tell us about your podcast, first of all, and what drew you to the Darrell Ewing case?
Unjust and Unsolved is on the Obsessed Network with Patrick Hines, who's a good friend of both of ours. And so we had this idea of starting a podcast where, you know, I really wanted to cover criminal justice. I got really into it doing the Suave podcast. And so I wanted to do wrongful convictions. I mean, truly, besides Undisclosed and Jason Flom and Bob Ruff, there really aren't too many out there. So I thought, you know what, let me do this. This is something I care about. And so Darrell was one of the first people who got back to me. He emailed me and said, you know, I really want you to cover my case. And, you know, I can even get you one or two celebrities to talk about me, too. And so that really stuck out to me that he had these big celebrities. You know, 42 Doug is a pretty big rapper now, who is one of Darrell's biggest supporters. I mean, he performed at the BET Hip Hop Awards in October with a shirt that said Free Them Boys and Darrell's name was on it. Hmm. So that really stuck with me, how many people Darrell had behind him. And then when I started looking into the case, you know, it just really fits into this pattern of systemic corruption, specifically in Detroit, which I talk a lot about in my episode.
Hmm. So what are your impressions of Darrell since you've been in touch with him and talked with him?
I mean, you know, one of the things that I think I often struggle with as a journalist and, you know, also a human, one of the big themes of Suave podcast is that, you know, he's really become a friend of mine now. I truly care for Darrell. I care for his family. I think he is a wonderful person. He's written a book while in prison that I've only started to read. I haven't had much time, but I mean, he's a truly wonderful person and was a wonderful person. And his entire life was just derailed by this truly horrific wrongful conviction. I mean, they're all horrific, but he had an alibi. He has somebody confessing. I mean, it's truly a nightmare.
Hmm. Can we just flesh out something you just said a little bit? Because it's one of my favorite topics, the idea, the sort of very, I'm comfortable calling it old-fashioned idea, sort of rooted in the supremacy of like old white men in the journalism profession, of not being able, technically, that one of the rules, the old school rules of journalism, is to not connect personally with a subject. But don't you think that in order to do justice to a story that someone has to tell that could make a huge difference, especially that it's just a lie to pretend that you can do that without making connection to your subject?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And I think, you know, Colin could maybe speak on this too. I mean, he might have it a little easier saying like, hey, look, I'm this really fabulous lawyer, talk to me. I mean, when you go into somebody as saying, I'm a journalist, you've been wrongfully convicted, their sense of trust is really just out the window. So, you know, I really do have to work hard at building trust. And one of those things that I do is just use my humanity and show them, I'm a person. My intention is not to screw you over. And here's how I'm going to show you that. Like I will show my humanity, my kindness, and I will be a person to you because you are a person. So yeah, like Maria has said, that's a tool in our toolbox. And I do use that. And it's not fake either. I mean, I stay in touch with him. I covered his case 7 months ago. And, you know, technically he doesn't, you know, quote, mean anything to me anymore in that sense. I'm not getting anything from him, but we stay in touch. He's become a person I care about, and I don't feel comfortable having somebody, you know, spill their guts and their life story and the worst day of their life to me and then just being like, all right, my story's over. Goodbye.
Right.
So
Right.
I'm not that kind of person. So it just so happens they become my friends.
Yeah, certainly being human does not necessarily lead to bias. I think that's a huge misconception, and it's one I think that's still being propagated, and it's not for the benefit of journalism, I don't think. Colin, lawyers also have to operate under a lot of ethics guidelines and rules around relationships with clients, but this is one that a lot of lawyers, you know, this is something that people are comfortable with. Your lawyer can become your personal advocate and friend. I mean, we've covered cases on your show where that's been the case. Are there like kind of written rules around that stuff besides, you know, the, you know, intimate relationships, you know, you're not supposed to have with clients?
Well, this is interesting. There was a story going around social media about a week ago, and it was about a female attorney and doctor who had worked to get a man who was serving a life without parole sentence released. And then she felt she developed this personal relationship, referred to this man as her brother. And then he was released and she felt burned, and in fact is now saying, oh, we should not let these types of people out because he used me and now doesn't want to be my friend on the outside world. And so it's, you know.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I think she probably has some issues that need to be dealt with. But there is, if you look on Twitter, it's being discussed a lot. So I think, you know, Rebecca, to your point and to Maggie's point, I have the same philosophy. The people that I work with on the podcast, in my role as an attorney, you have to keep it professional, but I'm happy to be in these people's lives and to keep in contact with them. Jonathan Irons, who we covered, I was just texting with him the other day, and that's great. So you should welcome it, but you shouldn't expect it. So in other words, they might want to keep it professional and just, you're serving as my attorney or my legal counsel, you're helping me out. I don't feel like they owe me anything when they're out, but if they want to continue that personal relationship and friendship, absolutely, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, one of the main, she's not a character, she's a real person, but one of the main figures in probably my favorite book that Kevin and I wrote, she and I have recently gotten in touch on social media and so forth, and I was looking at her last name and I was like, that's really familiar. She married her defense attorney, I guess, after she got out and after it was the thing was completely adjudicated and couldn't be adjudicated anymore. But I thought that was really interesting. It's not something you certainly hear about very often. So, Abigail, back to you. As I mentioned, you are Colin's student and you're his research assistant. Did you think when you came into law school that you wanted to work on wrongful convictions, or did that passion come from being in law school?
So when I came into law school, I really just had like an overall passion for advocacy. Like, I wasn't really sure the best way to advocate for people, but I knew that I wanted to try to advocate for people who were not in a position to do it as fiercely as other people may be able to. And so I had seen, you know, some wrongful convictions come across social media that had definitely piqued my interest and desire to help. But it wasn't until Dean Miller's class, my first year of law school, that I realized my individual passion for the work that goes behind and goes into working on wrongful convictions. And I also realized how many of these cases exist. I mean, contrary to the opinion some might hold, I'm sure not people who listen to this podcast, but there are, you know, very few people have the belief that there are very few wrongful convictions in our legal system, and that's just not true. So when Dean Miller gave me the opportunity to begin working on cases with him, I really just fell in love with the idea of helping people who otherwise might feel like they didn't have any other options left or that society had kind of forgotten about.
Yeah. You know, Maggie, I think about this all the time. I really think that Serial was really a sea change in journalism and taking a look at wrongful convictions or potential wrongful convictions. I think before that, editors and certainly the book editors I worked with, they wanted stories of fully adjudicated cases that if they shined a light on any bigger issue, it was issues around victims and it was issues around, you know, how long it took to catch the criminal, not issues around how we got it wrong. Do you feel appreciative of the fact that we are now looking this way in journalism and really, really strongly leaning that way, getting people to think about what is wrong here? I think it's really influenced the conversation in the last few years that this has become such a huge part of pop culture. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Serial, absolutely. I think Serial deserves a ton of credit for that. And I know, you know, there's things that may have been wrong or, you know, whatever, gotten wrong or whatever. But
we can go back and just re-edit it, you and me, Maggie. It'd be a totally different podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know, you know, there are certain issues with Serial. There's issues with a lot of podcasts. But I mean, Serial came out, I think, 2014? And that was right when I was actually entering J school. I was doing my master's, and that was when I was deciding to go into audio. So Serial was super impactful in my life and what I want to do. So I definitely give it a lot of credit, at least in my life, but in a lot of long form storytelling as well.
It's so surprising to me that it wasn't a huge topic, in journalism, really like a mainstream topic before then, because talk about shining a light, right? I mean, I think about a podcast like In the Dark, which looked at a wrongful conviction case, and the reporting in that podcast made it to the Supreme Court, was actually in the briefs filed in the Supreme Court. And it showed so many things, not just about the criminal justice system in that community, but about the power of elected prosecutors and about evidentiary problems. I mean, it really showed so many things. And I just feel like the opportunities for that in a story like this they're endless, right?
Absolutely. And I also do give so much credit to Making a Murderer, because I think some people still don't even understand podcasts. Like the amount of people who message me and say, where can I watch your podcast? People just
Same.
Are not understanding audio. So for a Netflix movie to be about a wrongful conviction as well was also a huge sea change.
Oh, I totally agree. I totally agree. So, Colin, how did you come to cover Durrell's case?
Yeah, so we have our tip line on the Undisclosed website, and we got a phone message from Lasagna Dodson, who is Durrell's mother, who's been a huge advocate for him over the past decade. And we heard in the podcast how much strain that's put on her. And I think we were covering the Temujin Kensu, the Fred Freeman case at the time, which was a Michigan case. And Susan was about to start the Jeff Titus series, which, of course, is also Michigan. And so thinking back to our Philadelphia series, we thought, oh, it might be good to have all these Michigan cases back to back to back. And so getting that message and starting to look through the files, I think similar to Maggie, just so many things jumped out to me, including, of course, the confession that we mentioned, as well as the alibi, and thought this would be perfect to cover after we finished Jeff Titus.
Now, the alibi is, as far as I'm concerned, like pretty freaking airtight. We have multiple relatives and people who saw Durrell at this party. They're able to peg the time that he was there because of this whole slideshow situation where they knew that was happening at a certain point in the party and that they couldn't get the media working right. So he kind of jumped in to help. So it was very specific, completely credible. Have you ever looked at a case like this before, Colin, where it's just like, this guy didn't do it? I mean, it's just so unbelievably obvious, except for the airplane one, which we'll talk about in a second, but he didn't do it. I mean, and it's just on its face so obvious. Have you looked at something that is this clear before?
I think this is probably, other than the Pedro Reynoso case, which is currently being reviewed in Philadelphia, where he was in the Dominican Republic at the time of this homicide in Philadelphia. That was pretty airtight. I hope that Larry Krasner and his office will soon overturn that. But besides that, yeah, to have them not only say, like, we have this documented repass, but also we know this slideshow, which, as Professor Barton noted, it's a typical part of a repass to celebrate the life. And we know we're Luddites. We're not tech savvy. Durrell was. He threw parties. And we can say we knew when the repast ended, he was helping with this slideshow. We had this shared memory. And it's multiple witnesses, all of their memories overlap. That's pretty darn strong.
You point out in the podcast, and you know, I believe that it's true as well. I think the data would probably support it. And I'd love your take on this, Abigail, about why it is that Black defendants with solid gold alibis, the alibis are not as believed as with white defendants. I mean, obviously racism is the reason why. But what do you make of the fact that this jury just rejected this, what seems to be an airtight alibi?
I mean, you said it. I'm trying to think of another way other than just racism and implicit bias that exists within the minds of people to explain it. But it honestly just kind of leaves me at a loss for words. I mean, in this case, you have the airtight alibi. And then, you know, obviously there are things that came up later that weren't discussed as much during like the actual trial, but just the unwillingness to believe. I think that it's also interesting that the jurors that went looking for, you know, extra information that maybe might not have been done so in another case, maybe with a white defendant or not. And I know Dean Miller has much more like data and statistics to back this up. And I know that he's researched implicit bias and the role that it plays, and sometimes not just implicit, just sometimes racism, of course, that exists amongst juries and within the entire system. But it's interesting to look at the different approaches that specific defendants get. And I honestly, I don't really know of another way to describe why someone else would be deemed as less credible, especially in a case like this, when you have multiple people attesting to the same thing, not just Durrell saying that he was somewhere specific, but other people backing him up, why that's somehow less credible than if maybe a white defendant with white individuals at a repass would not be considered to be lying. Hmm.
I think about this all the time, Maggie, because the criminal justice system, especially at the trial portion, really seems to, also I think the investigative portion, but it really seems to rely on what is considered somehow a fact that, like, all Black people stick together and would lie for each other and will always side with another Black person. This is why Black jurors are very often excluded from trials, because there's this assumption that they will never find a Black defendant guilty because, again, it's a very racist stereotype and trope that, quote, they all stick together. But I find myself thinking about this all the time and how it's like, parts of the justice system are actually built around that racist stereotype. What do you think?
Well, actually, in this case, it's really interesting because the Black jurors are the one who told the white juror, Kathleen Byrne, who came forward, that she was racist when she thought that the photos of Tyree and Durrell looked similar. Hmm. So in this case, it actually was the Black jurors who were pushing more towards the guilty verdict than this white woman. And she's the whole reason she came forward after and said, you know, they, you know, pressured me into this. They told me I was racist because these photos looked similar. And actually, if you look at them, they look very, they do look really similar. So, you know, it's really fascinating. And I don't, you know, I don't really have much else to say other than, you know, it's a fact, and it's horrible that Black folks are rejected from jury pools.
Yeah. There is a lot of data to support this, right, Colin, that in the court system, especially the criminal justice part of the court system, that, like, the implicit bias stuff, it's not just sometimes, like, it's pretty much all the time that it comes into play. Like, even in cases where somebody is clearly guilty, you know, there's this idea of, you know, excluding Black jurors. I mean, if you imagine, like, a case where a white man was accused of a crime and they're like, okay, we need to exclude all white guys from this jury. It just would never happen. Right, Colin?
Yeah, there was a study a few years ago by, I think, the Equal Justice Initiative, and it looked at, unfortunately, Southeastern states, including South Carolina, and it just found how disproportionate it is. There's what are known as for-cause challenges. The person might not be a resident of the jurisdiction, or they might not speak English. And then there are peremptory challenges, which are challenges without a reason given. And historically, you didn't have to give a reason. Batson versus Kentucky says, well, you can now challenge that. And of course, that's what happened in the Curtis Flowers case, where over six different trials, the prosecutor there, Doug Evans, used these in a discriminatory fashion. So certainly, yeah, studies show peremptory challenges are used in a discriminatory fashion against people of color. And then, as Abigail was noting, my most recent research project was about implicit bias in the criminal justice system and having an implicit bias jury instruction. Yeah, studies and statistics all show that in similar cases with similar evidence, juries, whether they be actual juries or experimental juries, they convict African-American people, people of color, at a much higher rate than Caucasian defendants.
Well, and also, you know, and it's not even just in juries. I mean, they just put out that study in the Journal of Forensic Sciences about the medical examiners.
Right.
I don't know if you guys saw that, but for listeners, very reputable journal, the Journal of Forensic Sciences, they had a bunch of medical examiners with the same exact case, same exact evidence. A young child had a head concussion or something and died from it. And so half of the medical examiners were told this is a white child brought in by their mother. And then half were told this is a Black child brought in by the mother's boyfriend. The medical examiners were more likely to find homicide a cause of death when it was the Black child and the Black family.
Right, right.
The same exact evidence.
Hmm.
And now we see AI and facial recognition. You're starting to see cases percolate about African-American defendants who are arrested, charged, maybe even convicted because the facial recognition software, the AI, the programming that goes into it, it tends to disproportionately impact people of color.
Yeah, it doesn't. They didn't write that into the algorithm, right? Probably because there were only like white people in the room when they were writing the algorithm. You know, it seems to happen in every aspect of our society. I mean, same thing with medical and drug testing, right? Like drugs are predominantly tested on white people, predominantly on men. And so there's this whole lack of data about the effects of medications, about sort of how, you know, other genetic factors might come into play with treatment. And, you know, it seeds distrust that's, I think, very earned, you know, by all of these institutions.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not just people of color we're talking about. It's also defendants who are women, where a huge proportion who were convicted, there wasn't actually a crime. And shaken baby syndrome is probably at the heart of that for a lot of those wrongful convictions. And so, yeah, I mean, definitely the criminal justice system in so many layers is designed with a white man in mind for the protections. Right. And those don't extend to people outside of that group.
Right.
You know, this also directly relates to why Darrell is even in prison in the first place. It's not just his trial, but the fact that he was a young black man hanging out in groups of other young black men, he was labeled as a gang member.
Right.
Doesn't happen. It rarely ever happened to young white men hanging out in groups together.
Right.
And Lasagna and I talked a lot about that. And that's how he even wound up pinpointed for this crime, because he was labeled a gang member because he was a young black man running parties.
Right. Now, Colin, can you just remind me of the astonishing thing that Darrell told you? And I would love to know if you have looked into this at all. He told you that basically the cops told him that they knew he didn't do it, but that they needed something from him. Otherwise, they would make sure he was convicted. Is there evidence to support that move that the cops made on him?
There's not evidence, and the officer, Theo Williams, isn't willing to speak. But both his mother and Darrell both say when he was arrested, that was what he was told. We know you didn't do it, but you're going to take the fall unless you point the finger at someone else. And there's not a huge, as Maggie knows from looking through the files, there's not a huge amount of documentation, and specifically not documentation of the interviews of Darrell. And so, you know, we can to sort of take him on faith. There's not anything to challenge it. There's not anything sort of back it up.
Anne on Twitter asked if anyone has looked at the prosecutor's other convictions in this case. I'm actually curious about the cops. You know, we heard in the Philadelphia cases that you guys covered the same cops over and over and over again. We've seen that in Baltimore, the same cops over and over and over again appear in these corruption cases and wrongful conviction cases. Is that the case in Detroit, too? Do the same cops appear again and again and again? Or is it spread throughout the entire police force there at this point?
I haven't looked at it that specifically. I know Kim Worthy, who's handling this case, she is the chief prosecutor for Wayne County, which covers Detroit. She has a conviction integrity unit, and there's been a ton of exonerations over the past few years for Detroit, but I haven't looked, and I don't know, Maggie, if you've looked at all, specifically to see whether these officers or this prosecutor in the case have had any of their convictions overturned.
I think I did look. I don't want to say if I found nothing, because right now I have nothing, but I think I looked. But Kim Worthy did put out this list of two dozen officers who had like flagrant misconduct that they're not even allowed to testify as expert witnesses anymore. So there is a ton of corruption, and that's kind of what I mentioned at the beginning. So in 2008, the crime lab was closed down, the ballistics unit specifically, which Darrell's case is a ballistics case, it was closed down because they were finding that the lab wasn't up to code and that there were people that were being wrongfully convicted. Darrell's evidence didn't go to that lab, but this was just a year before. Their ballistics testing lab was shut down in Detroit. Yeah. His went to the state lab, but, you know, and then in 2017, there was another cop who was planting evidence. He was found that he was planting evidence for years. And so he went to prison. I mean, the Detroit system is incredibly corrupt.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really, you know, that's not the only list that exists like that. As we've talked about before, Colin, a lot of states have lists of corrupt cops who cannot, or cops, problematic cops. They're not all corrupt, but some of them just have other issues that basically disqualifies them from testifying in trials. In New Hampshire, that list is secret. It's called the Lori List. There's an ongoing case over it. There's a podcast called The List by Bear Brooks, Jason Moon, if you want to hear more about it. But like in some states, that list is becoming public, right? Where does that stand right now?
Yeah, there's a few places, including Philadelphia, of course, with Larry Krasner, where they've made that public. And as you say, there's litigation in New Hampshire and other states where they're trying to make it public. And of course, right, you're a defendant. There's this list that exists. You want to know, especially if you've been convicted and you're claiming a wrongful conviction, is the chief investigator, are any of the police officers who handled my case on this list? Because that could be huge. But yeah, that's currently being litigated in a bunch of places.
That's right. And did the cop who arrested me, were they trained by somebody on the list too? I mean, I think there's a lot of questions there.
New York has one as well. That's public.
Yeah. Does it have a name like the Lori List? Usually these things seem to have names after a case, or is it just called like the bad cop list?
Yeah, I don't remember what it's called. I remember looking at it, though, because I know a lot of cops in New York, and I was like, let me see if you're on this.
Yeah. Well, since Larry Krasner has come up like three times so far, I just want to put a plug in for anyone who is not watching Philly DA on PBS, which is a multi-part documentary about Larry Krasner and what happened after he was elected DA in Philadelphia. It's fascinating. You should totally check it out. It is sort of like the undisclosed fantasy where a guy comes in and just immediately fires everyone who's been doing a bad job and immediately starts enacting changes that everybody hates. It's really, really incredible and worth watching.
Well, and he just won the primary.
Yes.
Who he beat Carlos Vegas, who is notoriously corrupt. But I believe he was one of the prosecutors that Krasner fired and then ran against him and lost.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. All right. So, Abigail, at the end of episode one and then in episode two, we hear directly from Tyree Washington admitting to the murder with nothing to gain. In fact, having a lot to lose by admitting to this murder. What were your thoughts, Abigail, when you first heard this confession?
Honestly, when I first heard Tyree's confession, I was impressed with his continued attempts to take responsibility for the murder. I mean, like you said, he has nothing really to gain in this situation. I mean, according to him, he does, you know, from a spiritual and religious place and just gaining peace and obviously just wanting to see the right thing done. But in terms of like a prison sentence, he isn't serving a life sentence, and he very well probably would. I think I can say more so than could. When all of this moves forward and hopefully when Daryl is released, and hopefully, I say that with fingers crossed, but I mean, he discussed his attempts to confess previously and his efforts to contact the prosecutor while confessing in the video that I listened to from him, the audio. And honestly, I would feel like some would be met with that opposition and decide it just wasn't worth continuing to make amends. I mean, when you've tried over and over again and you're going to be in a worse position and no one seems to really care what you have to say anyways, it would be easy for him to have, you know, done one sworn affidavit and said, I'm done. I'm not going to continue. But his continued efforts just, I mean, they really impressed me. And it also just further solidified my opinions on the prosecutor's mishandling of Darrell's case in the first place. And the continued opportunities that she has had to right the wrong that is Darrell's conviction.
Colin, did the prosecutor know about this confession when the trial was going on?
So definitely we know from the court hearing that the FBI came forward and said we had proffer communications, in other words, discussions in connection with the carjacking case that involves Tyree. And so she knew that he came forward and said that Tyree had confessed. Tyree additionally says in both his affidavit and his recorded statements that he signed an affidavit and gave it to Cam Towns, the prosecutor. It seems clear that she had a few levels of knowledge that he was coming forward and confessing to this and sort of put the blinders on and said, I'm going to ignore this because I have the person I want to prosecute.
Let me guess. It remained undisclosed in the trial. Let me guess. Just a guess. Is that what happened?
You know, the jury heard from the fellow inmate who said he confessed twice. They heard from the woman that he was dating. And she said, you know, the day of the repast, I was cutting hair. I couldn't attend the repast. And he came and said he had shot this guy at the same corner, the intersection where the murder took place. So they heard from her. They heard from the inmate, but they didn't hear directly from Tyree Washington. And that's maybe how the jurors were able to disregard it and say, well, if he's really taking credit, so to speak, and admitting to this, why isn't he in the courtroom confessing himself?
So what are the barriers? I mean, Scott Madison is asking on Twitter, ATX Scott, exactly the question I think probably every single listener of this podcast has right now. I'm sure there are barriers. How is it that he is still in prison despite, of course, the undisputed alibi, which we discussed, and these confessions? I know there's process and there's always barriers. What are they in this case?
Well, this is where it's interesting. So, I mean, I don't want to reveal too much, Rebecca, but this case is in a different posture than our other cases. The answer is his conviction is no longer valid. It's been thrown out. We'll discuss that in more detail later. Question then becomes, is the prosecution just going to drop the case or are they going to proceed to a retrial? And right now, and I'll read the statement in either episode 3 or 4, prosecution's position, Kim Worthy's position is, we think that Darrell Ewing committed this murder. We don't care what Tyree Washington says. We're taking this case back to trial.
Fantastic. All right. So I want to talk about another case that you and Maggie have in common, Colin. One of the cases I sort of referred to earlier was the case of Temujin Kensu, a.k.a. Fred Freeman. And listeners to this podcast might remember, because I talk about it all the time, this was the case where it was alleged that this guy chartered a plane to get somewhere that was many hours away to commit a murder. This is somebody with no money who had also a very solid alibi. You also covered this on Unjust and Unsolved, Maggie, and I'd love your take on that case. It's one of the ones that I think about all the time. It's just so emblematic of something that is completely effed up in every way. What is your take on that case?
There is really no other word besides absurd. It's fantasy. I mean, the fact that he was convicted of this is truly remarkably insane. He's a ninja killer that teleported until they made up this plane theory that, you know, he chartered this plane 400 miles away to commit a murder of some kid. It's absurd. And Temujin is one of the people I've talked to that has spent the most time in prison. Besides Ronnie Long, who did 44 years, Temujin's done 34 years, which is an ungodly amount of time for something that you very clearly did not do.
Yeah. And this is also a case, and we've talked about other cases like this, including the last season here on Undisclosed, where really the personality of the defendant came into play, right? Like, this is somebody not everybody liked. They found him, you know, off-putting or strange, or, you know, he had this whole, like, ninja thing going on, and was on the table, weirdly.
Yeah, to me, it's kind of like, it's not racism because he's a white man, but it's more like this xenophobia kind of, because he was very into Western religion and Western culture, and, you know, he converted.
Eastern, you mean, right?
Yeah. And so it was more of this like xenophobia of like, they didn't understand. And so it was scary to them that he could use nunchucks and, you know, had a prayer altar. So he was a Satanist and he rode a motorcycle. You know, it was like, they really piled on to this xenophobic issue. And also, we have to think this was in like satanic panic time, too. So everyone was just bonkers all around.
Yeah, this the othering. I mean, it's very easy, I think, for, you know, prosecutors to sort of take that stance. But yes, the magical ninja powers were really, really something. Now, Abigail, Colin tells me that you're currently working on another case, the Adam Toledo case. What can you tell us about that and about your work on it?
Yeah, so I've been comparing cases with facts similar to Adam's that have resulted in settlements. And so at this point in the process, I've just kind of been locating articles based on names that Dean Miller will give me and then compiling a report of sorts, like comparing the facts of both and then kind of trying to weigh if one seems a bit more egregious than the other. And they all seem pretty egregious. But it's been really, really interesting research. And I've learned a lot about already just about some of the more common serious issues that lead to these kind of, you know, police involved shootings and terrible outcomes. I mean, specifically, just as an example, the response time and then the officer's amount of time before shooting has been one of the most eye-opening things for me to see, just a sheer amount of seconds between arriving on scene and deciding to pull a trigger that's been fairly consistent in all of the cases that I've looked at thus far. So I'm hoping that the research will take us somewhere hopeful in terms of Adam's case specifically, but it has definitely been very eye-opening to see the issues that exist in police structures currently.
Yes. And for listeners who aren't familiar, this was the case a couple months ago. A 13-year-old boy, a child, was being pursued by police. He was allegedly seen holding a handgun at the end of the chase and was shot. There was no gun on him, but they found one allegedly behind a fence later, which, Colin, I mean, there are a lot of facts in this that, I mean, you can't help but think about, like, the Gun Trace Task Force and the Baltimore Police Department. You can't help but think of all of these stories we hear about, you know, not only decisions that are made by cops with somebody who may or may not be holding a weapon, but also the way weapons, and again, I obviously wasn't there, but how weapons can magically appear to sort of bolster a story like that. I mean, you can't help but think that, right?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, Rebecca. So an update to our listeners who listened, Amelia McDonald-Perry had the series on Keith Davis Jr., which, of course, involves issues with the Baltimore Gun Task Force, and he had his conviction thrown out again based upon the jury not being instructed on the presumption of innocence, and his case involves all those issues, and that's a case where it looks like it's going back to trial. This would be the fifth murder trial for Keith Davis Jr., the sixth trial overall, and so Abigail, I haven't told you yet, but we're at least in talks with that team, so we might be assisting for that sixth trial for Keith Davis Jr. But yeah, it's these police shootings, Breonna Taylor, the Andre Hill case that my students and I worked on, this Keith Davis Jr. case, they're all certainly troubling in different ways.
Yeah. Now, Maggie, we talked about your podcast, Suave, and I want to hear about Murder and Alliance in a second. So how would you describe Suave to listeners who haven't heard it yet? Like, what is the log line you would use to tempt them? Because aside from me saying it's one of the best podcasts I've listened to in years, how do you describe it?
And me too.
Thank you. Gosh, I mean, it's so difficult to make a log line, but ultimately, it's about a juvenile lifer who, you know, was convicted and got out after 31 years, after, you know, juvenile lifer laws changed. And then it really is more about people and humanity and, you know, how this man's life changed in prison, how he met journalist Maria Hinojosa and how they connected and developed a relationship. There are so many levels to it that I think, you know, when I was listening to you guys on Crime Writers On, I wasn't even realizing some of the levels that we like touched on that, you know, there are. There's humanity, there's criminal justice, there's a potential wrongful conviction. There is just so much that we touch on. So that's definitely not a log line, but that's what it's about.
Yeah. I have a question for you that I know Kevin raised during our podcast, but we've talked about it a lot, is that, you know, the decision was made for Maria to not host the podcast, but to be a subject of it. And you're the producer. You ended up hosting the podcast. And you were really in a position in a studio with her, asking her some difficult questions, really like poking and prodding at some of those sort of journalistic rules and how she felt about them and her actions here and her actions there. I mean, one of the things that's very interesting is, of course, her being asked to give a character reference for him at his parole hearings. So many complicated things, but I mean, she was essentially your boss, right? And here you are kind of like asking her these very difficult questions. What was that like?
It's funny because a lot of people do talk about that and wonder about that. And first of all, if you know me, I'm not scared of anybody, especially Maria Hinojosa, because she's actually a wonderful person. And so she picked me specifically to do this podcast with her because I think she knew it was going to entail some very difficult questions. And I think she knew that I would be able to ask her those questions despite her being my boss. And Maria and I had known each other for years before this. So, you know, she was my boss, but she was also a friend. And you know, we had some mezcal shots one night in Austin, and I told her, like, hey, look, you gotta, if I ask you things, you need to not be mad at me. Like, this is what we have to do to get this story out properly.
Right, right. And do you feel like you succeeded? I mean, one of the levels I think that the podcast really succeeds on is, you know, sort of I do love when podcasts explain journalism to non-journalists, because it is a thing that just people don't know about, especially in this podcast landscape where there are so many shows being made by people who, you know, in some cases are acting really irresponsibly or who just don't seem to get that there are just guidelines to being a human being who happens to be reporting something. But do you feel like the podcast also succeeds in sort of showing why some of those old school rules are old school and shouldn't matter and shouldn't have the weight that they do?
I do. And I think, you know, if we had 10 episodes, we could have done that more. I think, you know, of course, if we had 20 episodes, sure, we would have killed it. And I think that is something we probably could have touched on more. Like when I heard you say, you know, this was something that, you know, the old white establishment developed to make people of color feel like, I forget your exact words, it was much more eloquent, but basically invalidate people of color's style of reporting in a sense. I thought that was brilliant and something that, you know, would have been a great discussion to have.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, well, think about it. I mean, this is, I'm sorry to go so far astray here, but, you know, it's well known that like male political reporters in Washington, you know, socialize very often with their subjects. I mean, we heard on NPR after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died that Nina Totenberg, who covers the Supreme Court for NPR, was personal friends with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and had been for decades. She wasn't asked that question. She wasn't told, hey, someone else, a producer has to actually do your reporting for you here because, you know, you're friends with the subject. It is people of color, I think, and usually women, a lot of also younger people who are basically told that if they're human, they're biased. If they have feelings, they're biased. I just think it's a real problem that we need to solve.
Well, I think even the idea of objectivity is a problem that needs to be talked about more. And I talk about it a lot to my students, you know, who have also listened to Suave and have very similar questions. And they just want to know all about this. How do I handle this situation? And what do I do? And, you know, I definitely say be professional. I'm not paying these people to talk to me. I'm not, you know, having intimate relationships, like sexual ones. But, you know, I think being kind and close to somebody is not a problem. And I don't feel that violates any sort of ethics.
Correct. But if you are a woman reporter, you will be accused of having a sexual relationship with your subjects. It happens all the time.
Well, absolutely. And it's so interesting. I mean, Colin, I don't know if you ever get this. Maybe not, because you probably get to meet your clients in person. But I've had, you know, one guy I speak to, he's been on death row for 40 years in Philadelphia. He's never seen me. You know, they don't have the internet. And he's like, hey, can you send me photos? And at first I was like, I'm not sending you photos. Like, what kind of photos would I send you? And then I'm like, oh, he just wants to see who this person is he's been communicating with. You know, like, it's definitely an interesting situation, particularly as a woman.
Yeah. Colin, do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, you know, Maggie, to your point, I have met some of the people either in person, in prison, or through a video chat. But there's a decent number, including Darrell, who just know my voice and haven't seen me in person. So,
right, yeah,
I think, you know, this, I think, even applies to my own podcast. I think that people have different reactions in terms of when women are doing the podcasting and wrongful convictions and assumptions about their relationship with the subject versus, you know, when I cover the case of Pam Lanier, for instance, a male podcaster doing a female inmate, I don't think that anyone thought anything of it.
Right, right. Well, that is the double standard. I will say, for listeners who are wondering what Colin looks like, I can assure you he looks the most like his voice of anybody I have ever known in audio. I really do. I think you look like your voice. I really do. You're very tall. That's something that people should know. So, Maggie, we didn't talk at all about your podcast, Murder in Alliance. What is that about?
This one is the most exciting to me.
Okay.
Because I can kind of combine Suave and Unjust and Unsolved. So it's one of the cases from Unjust and Unsolved, the case of David Thorne, which is just one of the other most insane cases ever. We find this woman who every person around her had a motive to kill her, yet the one person who truly did not has been in prison for 22 years. So it's going to be the full 20 episodes of me, you know, diving into this, along with Jason Baldwin from the West Memphis Three and his private investigators, really trying to figure out who did kill this woman and how do we get David out of prison. And so episode 5 comes out this week, and I'm really excited to see where the podcast goes.
So, Colin, what is coming up on the next 2 episodes of Undisclosed? We will be taking the next 2 in the next addendum. So without giving away too many spoilers, I would love to know what we're about to hear as much as you can tell us.
Yeah, 2 main things. So I think Maggie previewed it a bit before. There was some jury misconduct in this case, and so we'll delve into the jury misconduct, as well as the reason there was that misconduct, going to Maggie mentioning about the gang affiliation theory that the prosecution tried to pursue. And then next episode, episode 3, we'll deal with there were 2 key eyewitnesses in this case, and we'll sort of go into their testimony. I'll have some expert statements on there about the nature of that eyewitness testimony. So eyewitnesses and jury misconduct would be the 2 chief issues.
So, Abigail, what are your plans? How many people are you going to get out of prison with the work that you end up doing? And do you have any final thoughts on this case that you want to share?
I would not want to jinx myself. I can only hope to be as successful as any one of you in y'all's professions, but especially and getting to see what Dean Miller does. If I can do like a portion of what he's done to help people, I will feel very, very successful. I would love to get anybody out that feels like they're not supposed to be there, or that there's proof that they're not supposed to be there. And I'm not just saying this because I'm one of his research assistants or students. I'm not going to get anything out of saying nice things about him. I just truly think that he cares so much. And as y'all were just saying, you know, sometimes empathy coming from any direction, female or male, can be viewed almost as a negative trait. I've been told that so much already just in my journey in law school, not from Dean Miller, but from other people, that caring is a problem. And so I think that y'all are all proof that it's not a problem, and it actually brings more attention to the issues going on currently. And I think especially in terms of Darrell's case, I mean, it's a perfect example of people caring from various different professions and coming together to try to get him justice. So I appreciate all of y'all's takes on that. And I wanted to get to say that before we close things out.
Well, Abigail, I am going to be setting up a Google alert for you, because I think we're going to be hearing a lot about you in the future. It was such a pleasure meeting you, Abigail. Thanks for giving us the inside scoop on Dean Miller.
Oh, thank you so much. Anytime you want to know anything about Dean Miller, I'm happy to give you the information. And I really appreciate y'all letting me join y'all today. So thank you.
And Maggie Freeling, you've got Murder and Alliance out now, Unjust and Unsolved. And of course, I want to tell everybody, please listen to Suave. It was wonderful talking to you again, and I hope I get to do it again soon.
Absolutely, Rebecca. Thank you. And there's one quick thing I do want to piggyback on, is that the wrongful conviction community is a community where it to me, everybody is trying to help. And there are so many supportive people. And I know you're going to totally get what I'm saying. Coming from missing persons, specifically the Maura Murray case, I have never experienced a community that actually truly bands together to help people. And it is so nice. And so thank you guys for having me on the podcast.
And Dean Colin Miller, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. This case has been spectacular to help you put together. Really, like, the number of holy crap moments I've had just in editing these 2 episodes has been astonishing. Thank you so much. And thanks for letting me talk to you about it.
Sure. Absolutely. And to echo Maggie's point, yeah, I mean, this is a terrific wrongful conviction community. I mean, you know, as we noted, you know, Maggie has covered some of the cases we've covered before, and this is a case she's covered before and we're covering. And a lot of times people ask, like, the families, oh, well, this, you know, someone else wants to cover this case you covered. Are you okay with it? Or, you know, in reverse. And it's absolutely, let's get as many people as possible looking into these and getting the word out. And that's the experience I've had with other podcasters in this community, is like, absolutely, this is not my property in any way. Let's have as many people as possible getting the word out there.
There's no selfishness when it comes to Wrongful Conviction. Rising tides lift all boats. I feel that way about great podcasts, too. And the podcast community, part of it's weird, but the part of it that's good is really good. And we really try to help each other out. So it's really a pleasure to be even tangentially involved with this work, Colin. So thank you for letting me be involved.
Absolutely.
And that does it for this week's addendum. If you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can just ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. And thanks to everybody who submitted their questions this week. Production for the addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. If you want to hear more of me talking about podcasts you should or maybe shouldn't listen to, check out my true crime review podcast. It's called Crime Writers On. Thanks so much to executive producer Methil Tellehan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be a part of their very important work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come in 2 weeks.